Happy Friday to you, and a very happy weekend as well. I hope you make sure you get to your home congregation's activities this Lord's Day, because we all need that so we can be encouraged to love and good deeds for the Lord. If you don't have a home congregation, you need to go out there and find one. And if you're actively looking and you happen to be within driving distance of the Elkhart East building, we cordially invite you to come and check us out. See whether or not you might want to settle down with us as your home congregation. Friday, I also like to say thank you very much to all who are providing the material support to keep us here on this radio station. May God bless you above and beyond what you could imagine or think. Also want to make a special thank you today to Kenny and Becca Engelmeyer. You don't know them, probably, unless you happen to be in a little tiny circle of those of us that do. But they have provided this parking ability for all of the archived material for Into the Word. So if you ever go to the website, intotheword.net, they're the ones that make that possible. So God bless them greatly. We're going to go to Judges chapter 16, verse 4 today, as we continue our look at the life of the last two judges, three judges, if you want to throw Eli in there as well. Remember that I believe that the chronology upholds the idea that Samuel and Samson were born right around the exact same time. At the beginning of the 40 years of Philistine occupation and aggressive activity against the Israelis under the high priesthood, the 40-year high priesthood of Eli. So we've kind of come to this pivot point in Israeli history that is wrapping up the time of the judges and opening the time of the kingdom. Now, when this part of our story takes place, starting in verse 4 of Judges 16, we have come to the end of Samson's part in all of this. We know that he leads as judge for about 20 years. So that's why I guess that he was probably around 20 when he began it, because it's connected to his first marriage, and now 20 years later is going to make him pretty close to 40, which means Samuel's probably right around that same age. This is also going to be the end of the very active Philistine aggression and occupation of the western portions of Israeli territory. Not because of what Samson does alone, but what happens under the leadership of Samuel immediately after Samson passes from the scene. When we've looked at most of the judges, we've only looked at their origin story, how they got started, who it was that they took down on behalf of God. And then we only know that when they died, the sin of Israel starts popping back to the surface again. Samuel and Samson, we hear the beginnings of their stories and the later portions of their stories. So they are unique in that aspect. Samson has been someone that is clearly impacted by his, shall we say, his emotions and his physical desires. The whole thing with his wife being messed around with the 30 companions that he had at their wedding, and that caused him to go out and pick a fight and kill 30 Philistines in another nearby city. and present the winnings of the cheaters in that contest of the puzzle or the riddle of Samson. That causes Samson to kind of walk away from that marriage a little bit, but then he tries to come back to it, doesn't he? And then he finds out that it's too late, and he takes his vengeance on the Philistines in the area. And then the Philistines take their vengeance not on Samson, but on the wife and in-laws of Samson, burning them. And then Samson wants to get even with them over that. And so we've seen this tit-for-tat thing, this back and forth, eye for an eye, tooth-for-tooth sort of judgeship at the beginning of Samson's time. But then we kind of settled down, and we understood that he was a judge for 20 years. We don't know the details. We only know that he kept the Philistines from having full oppression over the Israelis. He limited their capability of taking Israeli stuff for those 20 years. Then, at some point in that 20 years, and we don't know when, he goes and has a one-night stand, shall we say, with a prostitute down in Gaza, Philistine territory. And the Philistines think they can take him down at that point, but God gives him the physical ability to rip open the pedestrian gate and escape. And actually, he takes the gate with its bars and puts it on a nearby hill before he takes off back to Israeli territory. Again, we don't know when that took place, but we know it involves a woman. So now we've come to his final story. And guess what? It involves a woman. Perhaps a woman he wanted to be married to. It doesn't mention marriage, but it clearly indicates a much more intimate, lasting relationship than a one-night stand with a prostitute. So let's go ahead with that background to dive in to the climactic end of the story of Judge Samson. Judges 16:4. After this, he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. Now the word love there should be taken into consideration. This isn't a passing fancy. He wants this relationship. She's a Philistine again, just like his first wife, but he does want this relationship. She lives in the Valley of Sorek, which is the name of the river, the wadi, that drains this valley that he grew up in. And her name is Delilah. Now, what does Delilah mean? Some people have suggested it probably means feeble, something her mom and dad gave her. What happens next? Verse 5. The lords of the Philistines, remember there are five Philistine city-states there on the Mediterranean coast and then in the flat plain that comes up from that coast toward the territory of Judea and of Dan's hill country. Those five lords find out that one of their people, a Philistine lady, is in some sort of intimate relationship with the guy they hate, Samson, the guy that's caused them so much trouble. So they came to her and they said to her, seduce him and see where his great strength lies. So use your relationship to find out what his secret is, by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him, to humble him, to bring him down. And we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver. Now, we've talked about this idea that they don't have coinage yet. Silver is exchanged based on weight, but often it comes in just chunks and bits. And so there's no clear value here, but I'm going to give you something to at least use to get a sense of how much money they're offering her here. If these pieces each weighed a shekel, which becomes the standard weight for silver money, then each shekel is worth a couple of days' wages. And each one of these five guys is offering 1,100 of those. So 5,500 pieces of silver, perhaps shekels of silver, which would then translate into well over 10,000 days' wages. And if you want to put that in real money for us today, just think almost $2 million. That's a lot of money. And it turns her head. It turns her heart. And so she agrees to do it. Now, the way she's going to do it is that she has a little private group of Philistines hiding nearby in the actual house, apparently, where she starts playing games, presumably, with her boyfriend. And if the game works, where he can't get away, because it's a little bondage session, as we would say, then they're going to jump out and grab him. Verse 6. So Delilah said to Samson, "Please tell me where your great strength lies, how you might be bound, that one could subdue you." So it's a little love talk between lovers here. "Tell me your secret. Why are you so strong?" So Samson decides to play. "Well, if they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings that have not been dried, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." So he makes up a story. And she decides to try it out. So the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh bowstrings that had not been dried, and she bound him with them. So a little bit of time passes. They're back together again because this is a regular relationship, back and forth. She plays that little game. She ties him up with these fresh bowstrings. Now, she had men lying in ambush in an inner chamber. That's the guys I was talking about a while ago. They are not going to jump out unless she signals that he really is unable to get out of what she's tied him up with. So she said, "Oh, Philistines, they're upon you, Samson." So she's playing here. This is a little bondage play is what they're involved in. But he snapped the bowstrings as a thread of flax snaps when it's touched by fire. That simile was used earlier to describe when the Judeans had bound him with ropes, that they were like nothing. He just snapped them off like thread when it catches fire. And so the secret of his strength was not known. So she doesn't give the signal. It's obvious that he was messing with her. And that's what she says. Delilah said to Samson, "Behold, you mocked me and told me lies. Please, tell me now you might be bound." And he said, "Well, if they bind me with new ropes that have not been used, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." Again, the Philistines had tried to take possession of Samson once before when he'd been bound with ropes by the Judeans. And he just popped those things right off and killed a whole bunch of the Philistines. But he gives a little twist on it. He says, they have to be virgin ropes. They have to have never been used for anything. And so perhaps a little time passes by and they engage in their little play again. So Delilah took some new ropes. She bound him with them. And then she did the play acting. "Oh, the Philistines are upon you, Samson." The men lying in ambush were in an inner chamber, but he just snapped the ropes off his arms like a thread. So again, Delilah knows he's playing with her. He's not being truthful. And Delilah said to Samson, "Until now you've mocked me and you've told me lies. Tell me how you might be bound. You know, quit playing with me. Tell me the truth. You're cheating on me here." And so he makes up another story. He said to her, "Well, if you weave the seven locks of my head," which tells us how he wore his long hair. Remember, he's never had his hair cut from birth. So it's probably clear down his back. But it's not just loose. He's tied it up, woven it up into seven locks. And so he says, "Well, if you take these seven locks of mine and you weave them into a web for making material, and then you fasten it tight with a pin." It's talking about a hand loom here, it sounds like, that you finish your material before you cut it off. You kind of lock it in place on the loom with this pin. "Then I shall become weak and be like any other man." So, while he slept, again, and I don't want to go into all the details of this, but they are clearly involved in some sort of intimate relationship here. And so he is asleep. His head is in her lap. And so she takes a little hand loom that she has there for this very purpose, and she weaves quietly and carefully his seven locks into this hand loom, and then she made it tight with a pin. And then she did what she's always been doing at the height of the play. She wakes him up. "Oh no, the Philistines are upon you, Samson!" But he awoke from his sleep, and he just pulled away the pin, the loom, and the web. So he just rips it out of his hair, and he's all strong, like he always is. And then this is where she ups the ante. This is where she begins putting the pressure more heavily on him. She said, "How can you say I love you when your heart's not with me? You've mocked me three times. You haven't told me where your great strength lies." And when she pressed him hard with her words, day after day, and urged him, his soul was vexed to death. Now, if this sounds familiar, it should. It's a flashback to his wedding week, when from about day four onward, his new bride, his new Philistine bride, was crying her eyes out and probably claiming that he didn't love her over and over and over again because he wouldn't tell her the answer to his puzzle. And so this is the second time that a woman he cares deeply about has used relationship as a weapon and emotion as a weapon. And so eventually, he gives in. He gives up. Verse 17, he told her all his heart and said to her, "A razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If my head shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man." Now that is interesting. That tells us he puts a lot of stock into the no haircut part of his Nazarite vow. He believes that it is the reason for his strength, not cutting his hair, because he's already violated the other two major components of the Nazirite vow and still had his strength. That is, he was around those grapevines when he shouldn't have been touching them. And then he was also touching a dead body of the lion when he took the honeycomb out of its body and ate it himself and shared it with his parents way back at the time of his first marriage. So he puts this belief in the hair being uncut. I think the more significant reality is the haircut will be the last straw. It will terminate his Nazirite vow to God, and that will be what takes his strength away. Verse 18. When Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, so she really believes, wow, this time I think he's being honest with me. She sent and called the lords of the Philistines, saying, "Come up again, for he has told me all his heart." So she makes the arrangements once again to have that little group hiding out in her boudoir, in her nearby room, for when she has her little intimate meeting with Samson. So the lords of the Philistines came up to her. They brought the money in their hands. So they got the money with her this time because she has convinced them that he has convinced her what it's all about. And then she made him sleep on her knees. See, that's the reason why I talked about a while ago, their intimacy, the laying of a man's head in a woman's lap is very intimate. Okay? So she made him sleep on her knees. Then she quietly, shall we say, called for a man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his head. He must be a pretty sound sleeper when he's at Delilah's place. So they probably just snip off the 7 locks and then possibly shave him down to the skin. It doesn't guarantee that that's what the wording is here, but he definitely has a haircut, a major haircut. Then she did what she's done every other time. She began to torment him, basically saying, "The Philistines are here! Samson, break loose!" Because he's apparently tied up. And he awoke from his sleep, and he says, "I'll just go out as at other times. I'll shake myself free." But he did not know that he who is had left him. Now that has got to be the saddest line in this whole story. Samson was completely ignorant of the fact that God was no longer helping him out physically. And so the Philistines seized him, the little group of secreted away Philistines. They apparently right there at her house gouged out his eyes. How they did that, who knows? But he no longer can see, and he's never going to get his sight back again. He's done on that. And then they brought him down to Gaza. All of us know where Gaza is located now. It was the southernmost, I believe, city of the 5 cities of the Philistines. They bound him with bronze shackles. So they're not taking any chances. They actually have a nice set of bronze shackles made to keep him limited in his movements. And then he ground at the mill in the prison. So they've got him in a special detention facility, and they're putting him to work. They're making him be like an ox, grinding out the grain. And then time passes, and the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. And I believe he also begins to repent. Remember, repent is when you change your attitude. And he begins to realize that he was too full of himself. Now, the lords of the Philistines gathered to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice And they said, "Our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hand." So they decide to have a special party at this get-together of all of the Philistine peoples. When the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, "Our God has given our enemy into our hand, the ravager of our country, who's killed many of us." And when their hearts were merry, they said, "Call Samson that he may entertain us." And so they called Samson out of the prison, and he entertained them. And they made him stand between the pillars. Now, this Temple of Dagon, we don't have any archaeological remnants of it or any of the temples of Dagon in the lower Middle East, in the Philistine territory. So we have no real clue exactly what it looked like. But we do have a sense that it is two stories, because there's an upper portion to it, and that the upper story is held up by a series of pillars with cross beams between those pillars around. And Samson, in being mocked for the upcoming entertainment of the Philistines, is standing between two of these pillars. So they're not very far apart, are they? And so Samson said to the young man who held him by the hand, because he's blind, so he's being led, "Let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean against them." So he's basically saying, "I'm so tired. I just need to be able to catch my breath. I need to lean a little bit." Now the house was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there, so all five of the leaders of the city-states. And on the roof, there were about 3,000 men and women who looked on while Samson entertained. So if there's 3,000 up above, there might be as many as 10,000 in the whole place.